Broadcast out of New York City, you're listening to Prescriptions for Health on the Progressive Radio Network. On Monday, January 20th, 2014, I'm Dr. Len Saputo.
And I'm registered nurse Vicki Saputo. Thank you for joining us on Prescriptions for Health on the Progressive Radio Network on the first and third Monday of every month from 10 to 11 a.m. Eastern Time and from 7 to 8 a.m. Pacific Time. And remember, our shows are available 24/7 on PRN.FM and DrSaputo.com.
Today you'll hear Nurse Vicki's 2020 health tips at 20 after and 20 to the hour. And we've got another great show for you today that's going to include why you can't trust the CDC.
And why use a placebo when you can use a drug?
The ironic effects of weight-stigmatizing messages might surprise you.
And what mineral that treats osteoporosis can cause heart attacks and blood clots? Oh, no, here we go again.
All right. And do workplace wellness programs work? You'd be interested to see what Pepsi has to say. It may not surprise you so much considering who they are.
Well, here we go again. The flu season is upon us. Or is it? Well, there are people reported on the news to be dying from the flu, and people are being urged and frightened into getting the flu shot.
You're actually intimidated.
So is this truth or hype? Are the statistics overstated? And who is dying? Well, it sounds like we need to take another look at this topic because the facts are ignored for the most part or forgotten. So do you need a reminder as to why the flu vaccine is not the answer? Well, we're here to give it to you.
Boy, I'll say, I am fed up, sick and tired, disgusted, frustrated. I can't believe the audacity of the CDC. From my point of view, is if they do work like they do with the swine flu vaccine, they ought to be eliminated and banned from this country because they give us the wrong idea.
So who is the CDC?
Well, that's they are the
who makes up the Centers for Disease Control?
Well, this is an organization that's put together under Human Health and Services that was instituted by Congress, and their job is to take care of us, to make sure that the health of the country is protected. And what they do is they use techniques that are Orwellian. They're just like big on disinformation, big on fear, big on confusion, conflict of interest all over the place. And I and Vicki are qualified to say this. And the reason I say that is because in the 2009 swine flu epidemic, we followed the news every single day for about a year and tracked what the CDC and the rest of the country did as far as talking about this vaccine and the course of events that was associated with it. And it was a tragedy.
Well, it certainly was. And then that study that CBS did, too, pretty much exposed them.
Well, the whole thing, see, was made up. This wasn't a serious problem to begin with. And the whole epidemic started in Mexico. They were talking about how many people were dying of the swine flu. As it turned out, there were 7 cases of documented deaths from the swine flu in Mexico. Now, that doesn't make the start for a big epidemic. And then they changed the definition of what a pandemic is. A pandemic is when a disease goes from country to country around the world and people are dying and having serious disabilities from it. Well, they changed it conveniently in about March of 2009 to take away the dying and death part, or the death part, or the severe disability part, and just said, well, if it's in a lot of countries, then we'll call it a pandemic. Well, technically that's right, but from the point of view of does it make any difference? It's like tracking a cold around the country, around the world. That we don't care about tracking a cold around the world. What we care about is how is the health of the people and how many people are dying and what kind of suffering is there. And so to call this a level 6 pandemic, which is the highest level it can be at, would make you think it was like the Spanish flu in 1918, when apparently millions of people died.
Well, basically what they tried to do was to exaggerate the flu so people would get flu vaccinations.
You can call the CDC the exaggerati. Because that's what they are.
But there's no long-term studies to prove the efficacy of flu vaccines.
Well,
and most
right.
People just assume that there have been. And they don't seem to affect death rates. And when the flu shots were on the
rise,
they
don't even affect hospitalization rates or visits to doctors much. These studies have all been done.
When they were giving a lot of flu shots, it didn't have any effect on the death rates. And then
no.
When there was a shortage of vaccines, mm-hmm. There was no rise in mortality. And yet 65% of the elderly are vaccinated. And then the death rates went up with that.
Mm-hmm.
And yet they talk about these placebo-controlled trials and how they're unethical because the flu vaccine saves lives. So they just make this assumption, and everybody believes it.
Yeah.
Children that were vaccinated had no better response to the vaccine than to a placebo.
And these are huge studies that are done, too, that are published, and we don't look at it. When you see the hospitals and the infectious disease doctors and major medical centers all buying into this crap, it's unbelievable to me.
Well, you notice, though, that a lot of the healthcare workers didn't want to do it, but then they were totally penalized, too.
Well, a lot of them lost their jobs. If you don't,
and they made them wear masks.
Well, if you don't take the vaccine, you are required to wear a mask, and you don't get to wear that little smiley face button that said, "I had my flu shot." And it's sort of like you did something that was brilliant.
Okay, but there's more that I want people to know about, like about the FDA, because it uses its emergency authorization powers to approve vaccinations that are not tested for safety or effectiveness, and then got Congress to vote to give the H1N1 vaccine makers legal immunity from medical liability lawsuits.
That's right.
So that meant that there was a problem from the adjuvants, like the thymerosal and
or
stuff that was
any
in
other
there, that they're protected.
Right.
Yeah. And so now they're protected and they have no financial incentive to make safe vaccines. Plus, Congress gave the big pharma $7 billion at that time.
$7 billion, that's right.
Yeah, to advance the purchase of the vaccine.
If this wasn't a conflict of interest that protected the vaccine makers, I don't know what is.
The people need to really get this, really listen to this, because everybody gets scared. You hear on the news, oh, there's 13 people that have died in the Bay Area, or there were 10 children, or whatever the statistics happen to be, because they change every day.
You can't even believe those numbers, because
that's what I mean.
Yes, when the CDC came up with numbers back in 2009 talking about how many people died or how many people had the flu, CBS did their own study. CBS News did their own study. And they, under the Freedom of Information Act, requested information from the CDC that looked at the true incidence of how many people had influenza and how many people had the swine flu brand of influenza compared to other colds and flu-like illnesses that were present. And the wonderful CDC, bad sports, wouldn't give any of that information to them. So,
and then later they gave them statistics that were just projections on a computer.
Right.
And they also stopped keeping track of the deaths that were from the H1N1. And they counted everything, like flus and colds and everything were all in the same category.
They stopped trying to differentiate and be diagnostic about who died from what if they had a flu-like illness. They assumed they were all swine flu vaccines. But what did CBS find? CBS found that of the 13,000 cases that were tested in California, 2% were from the swine flu, and only a few percentage were from influenza of any type, let alone swine flu, which means that the chances of your having had influenza of any type was way against what they were saying. Florida had results that were a little bit higher. Maybe it was about 15%. But in general, the exaggerations of the CDC were unbelievable.
Well, this goes back to 1976 also, where there was like one death, and then they ended up vaccinating 40 million Americans. There was no pandemic, but there were serious side effects from the vaccines. Mm-hmm. 25 died from the vaccines, and 500 got Guillain-Barré syndrome. Mm. So it turned out that the flu vaccine was worse than the disease.
Oh, and, for sure.
Yeah.
Now, we can't say that about the 2009 epidemic of swine flu in terms of what the vaccine did. But try and get accurate numbers about what really did happen.
Okay, but the other day I was just hearing on the radio, they were saying that pregnant women should be getting the flu vaccine. And because of the dangers of the flu, the thimerosal can be used in pregnant women and children is what they said back in 1976, I guess, because they were so afraid of the flu.
That actually happened in 2009. When Schwarzenegger and the governor of New York both came out saying that even though we don't allow thimerosal to be given to kids in the flu vaccine normally or to pregnant women, that they were going to allow it now because this
was
a
horrible emergency,
which of course it wasn't. The American College of Obstetricians and Gynecologists noted on their website that no study to date has seen any adverse consequence of the influenza vaccine in pregnant women or their offspring. But there hasn't been anything like that because they haven't done any studies. And so to make a statement like that that's negative is a joke. But when you look at just the insert that comes with the flu vaccine, there's a warning that says safety and effectiveness have not been established in pregnant women or in nursing mothers for these flu vaccines. And yet they're still recommending it. Now, when Tom Jefferson, he's a physician who's the coordinator for the Cochrane vaccine field in Rome, reviewed 217 articles on the flu vaccines, he found 95% of these articles were flawed. And I've reviewed a lot of those, too, and I would agree with them. That's true. And one of the statements that they report was from a Dr. Anthony Morris, who was a virologist and former chief vaccine officer at the FDA. His comment was, there is no evidence that any influenza vaccine thus far has been effective in preventing or lessening the attack of influenza. So we've got a problem here of the CDC coming up with proclamations, making statements without backing up their stuff. And the only thing, only conclusion I can come to is that they're in cahoots with them, with the industry. And when you look at the fact that the head
We're talking
of the CDC,
lots of money here.
Julie Gerberding, a physician who was in charge of the CDC under the last president that we had. You know where she works now? For Merck. And what does she do? She's in charge of their vaccine department. And how much does she make? If it's similar to what other people in that position make, it's at least a couple of $1 million a year by the time you look at their stock options. So there's a revolving door that goes between the FDA and the CDC with the pharmaceutical industry. And in particular, when you're talking about vaccines, because the amount of money that they make there is staggering.
Well, yeah, like I just said earlier, you know, Congress voted to give the vaccine makers legal immunity from lawsuits. And also, they're now protected. They don't have a financial incentive to make safe vaccines because
right.
they're protected.
That's right.
And then the last time Congress gave Big Pharma all that money to buy the vaccines. So the other thing that's happened is it seems that they're so against natural substances because they're afraid, I guess, that those can compete
with
the
vaccine.
They don't
want any competition. It's becoming obvious.
I mean, the natural substances haven't been shown to be deadly or anything or have horrible side effects like the flu vaccine does.
Well,
it can build immunity, but they put a lot of companies in big trouble for trying to encourage people to take natural vitamins and things.
Well, look what they did to Andrew Weil.
Yeah.
I mean, here's an icon of a doctor in America who's into integrative health care, who is selling some products on his website like astragalus and saying that this could boost your immunity and might be something smart to take if you have a problem where you're being exposed to the influenza virus or any other cold virus. And they threatened to shut him down. And they did that to about 50 other people
makers. Like they were persecuting the alternative medicine. It's so weird to sit back and look at this whole picture because it does get a little confusing when you haven't
This is
it.
Really hard
but
to
like,
study.
But it's like, this is the American government?
You have to
This is democracy?
Yeah, well, the amount of work that you have to put into understanding what's happening in the flu vaccine industry and in influenza in general is tremendous. And that's why we've got people who are following the proclamations of the CDC, not questioning it. And you're finding hospitals and infectious disease doctors not doing original research. You're finding the newspapers coming out with articles that are saying we've got the flu seasons here again, go get your vaccine. And then they
Making
threaten you and tell you that we're running out of the vaccine, so you have to
Hurry
make sure
up,
you get yours now.
Make you want to go down there quick. And then subject yourself to the thimerosal because they're low on the kind that doesn't have it?
Well, I mean, let's just look at the fact that there isn't any solid data to show that the vaccine even works. There are a lot of reasons when you look at the immunology of it to suspect that that would be the case.
The strains are different all the time.
Well, this strain's the same one as it was in 2009. It's a swine flu epidemic again, they're saying. But when you look at the number of deaths that there are from this, it's not that many compared to what you're seeing from
other
diseases.
Well, look at all the deaths from diabetes and MRSA.
Oh, that's way worse.
And deaths from medicine.
Yeah, well, that's now
they're a lot higher and more deadly than the influenza.
Well, there are 400,000 deaths a year from the expected and unexpected side effects of medications in just the U.S. alone. When you look at the number of deaths that there are that the CDC is talking about, you know, they say 36,000 a year, but what they're talking about is anything that's a cold or flu virus is included in that, and it's not just the epidemic of the swine flu of the or the particular virus of the year that they're talking about.
Okay, so
only
a
few thousand
deaths
every year at
the
most.
So who's getting the flu now?
Well, these are people who've always been getting the flu. It's the people who you can't protect much because your immune systems are not so good. So if you gave them the vaccine, it wouldn't work. So those are the people with chronic diseases and with immunity that's not very strong. They're the ones that need it and it doesn't work. The rest of us who don't need it, we get the flu vaccine, which doesn't work. It's quite a system. I think it was made to provide people with people who are making these vaccines with a lot of income. You know, if there's 6 billion people in the world and they were talking about giving 4.5 billion people flu shots, they're looking at a $400 billion return on investment. You're talking about big dollars now. And so is our Congress clean? Is our Congress honest? Is it subject to being bribed by people who are giving them money, like the pharmaceutical industry or individuals who are connected to it? You better believe it.
Even our beloved Dr. Oz.
Well,
he got sucked in 2009.
Well, he kind of didn't. I mean, he took the vaccine himself because he had to. I mean, he had a job and he had to do that, or I'm sure he'd have had problems, but he didn't give it to his kids and he didn't give it to his wife.
But he also had 150,000 options on stocks in SIGA Technologies.
Well, that's right. So, I mean, what we're talking
about is a vaccine technology company. So yeah, that's a conflict of interest.
Well, it is. I can understand the pressures, and I don't want to put it all on him because I think he's doing good things.
No, but I'm saying
America,
even him.
Right.
I mean, there's a lot of temptations out there.
Sure. And Andrew Weil folded. I mean, I'm so proud of Andrew Weil's work. I think it's great. It's moving integrative medicine forward. And he didn't want to fight the CDC or the FDA, so he just stopped selling astragalus for a while. But now all that stuff is going back to where it should be, and people are recognizing that the corruption that exists between the CDC and Congress and the pharmaceutical industry runs deep, and there's lots of money involved. So we have to change the way things are operating in this country. We need a wellness system that's honest. We need research that tells the truth. We do the same thing in the oncology industry.
Why are we protecting a big manufacturing company that has so much money and so much power over the people?
Because they want more.
We're protecting them over the people.
It's about greed. They want more. And so if they can get it, isn't that the idea of big business?
They can make us sick or kill us.
Well, they don't care about that. I mean, look what happened with Vioxx. 50,000 people died in what I would call premeditated murder because the drug company knew that it was causing heart attacks and strokes, but it didn't stop them from still selling it anyway.
But
and then apologizing.
But this is bigger because this involves the CDC, this involves the FDA, and doesn't it also involve who? The World Health Organization.
Oh, the World Health Organization is a front for the same thing. I mean, what Margaret Chan did there was despicable. A level 6? I mean, that's like we're waiting for a nuclear blast to occur in our vicinity. I mean, that's just
and
a
yet
joke.
When there was a nuclear blast, like the Fukushima thing, it's like they keep trying
to
hide it.
They suppress that. Yeah, so have we got problems here? Yeah, we got problems here, and we need to make some changes. And what the big companies are hoping we'll do is fight them back. What I say is don't fight anybody back. Don't play their game. Just don't participate in it and set the example that you want to set so that you can set an example that people will be inspired to want to walk in your shoes or follow the path that you're following. That's what we need to do. So
stay healthy and build up your immune system and do all the healthy lifestyle measures.
Do the right thing. That's right. All right, you're listening to Prescriptions for Health. I'm Dr. Len Saputo here with Nurse Vicki, and it's time for Nurse Vicki's first 2020 tip on why English is so hard to learn. And when we come back, we'll be talking about why use a placebo when you can use a drug for migraine headaches. That's kind of got it backwards, doesn't it? We'll be right back.
Why English is hard to learn. We'll begin with box. The plural is boxes, but the plural of ox is oxen, not oxes. One fowl is a goose and two are called geese, yet the plural of moose is never called meese. You may find a lone mouse or a house full of mice, but the plural of house is houses, not heise. The plural of man is always men, but the plural of pan is never pen. If I speak of a foot and you show me 2 feet and I give you a book, would a pear be a beak? If one is a tooth and a whole set are teeth, why shouldn't 2 booths be called beef? If the singular this and the plural is these, should the plural of kiss ever be called keese? Well, we speak of a brother and also of brethren, but though we say mother, we never say methrin. Then the masculine pronouns are he, his, and him, but imagine the feminine, she, shiz, and shim. You know, it reminds me of Dr. Seuss.
Yeah, it is like that.
But no wonder there can be communication problems between cultures. If you're not born into the English language, I'd say good luck, you know.
You're really good at that. I remember when you were giving, you read for our granddaughter's class. All the kids were so excited when you'd come because you tell such a good story.
Well, thanks. So, how effective are placebo-controlled studies? Placebos are treated as if they have no effect in trials, and a new study in treating migraine headaches proves that the placebo effect accounts for 50% of pain relief, whether the patient's told they're taking a placebo or not. Now, I find this so interesting that the placebo works even when a patient is told it's a placebo.
It's hard to believe, isn't it?
Well, this result is similar to the one we talked about recently on irritable bowel syndrome.
Yeah.
But tell us about this migraine placebo study.
Okay, this was a study out of Harvard, okay, by a guy named Ted Kapchuk, who is a very well-known person who is the director of a program in placebo studies at Harvard. And it was published in a journal called Science Translational Medicine in January of this year. And basically, they looked at a way to quantify how much pain relief is attributed to a drug in the treatment of migraine. And in this case, they used a drug that's the latest cat's meow called Maxalt for it. And they looked at the effect of placebo. And what they found was that it demonstrates that a positive message and a powerful medicine are both important for effective clinical care. I think I'd agree with that.
But this is pretty great, because when you think about the symptoms of a migraine, I mean, those are like throbbing headaches with nausea and vomiting and diarrhea because it's so bad, and they're sensitive to light and sound and all that. And
it ain't much fun. That's right.
The other thing is that, you know, so many of these placebo double-blinded placebo control studies, they're treating a placebo as if it has no effect. That's how they can tell you why they deduct that they can tell you how effective the medication is or whatever else they're testing up against a placebo.
Yeah, well, they take the placebo effect out, which is usually about 30% of the effect that you see.
Well, this says 50%.
Well, in this particular case, that's right. But
this says a good medicine's effectiveness can be doubled by enhancing the placebo effect.
Oh, I think that's absolutely right. And what's amazing to me is if you tell a person they're going to get a placebo and you have a pill that's a nice pill that got placebo written on it, and you give one group that, and you give the other group nothing, and say, we're going to give this group a pill, but we're going to give you nothing, you still get quite an effect from the pill. I mean, when they did a study in irritable bowel syndrome a couple of years ago, what they did is they told these people that they were getting a placebo. They wrote the word placebo on it, and then they tracked them for 6 weeks, and what they found was is that the people on the placebo did a lot better than the people that didn't have it. It's the same thing with migraine headaches. So what we're looking at is the incredible effect of what you think on your biochemistry and physiology. If you believe something, even if you do it at an unconscious level, it has an effect on how you feel.
Well, this is really important because pharmaceutical pain pills come with side effects.
Oh, for sure.
Even other pills, but not just the pain pills.
There are no pharmaceutical drugs that don't have a profound effect on biochemistry and physiology. And the sad part about it is that we haven't got a clue what those effects are a lot of the time, except for the major ones that the drug companies have found. But when you look at all the biochemical reactions in the body, the tens of thousands of things that happen every millisecond in the body, there's no way we're going to be able to understand that. I think it's beyond human comprehension. And it always has negative effects, and that's why we always have side effects. The problem is we don't really study the side effects near as much as we do what we call the effects. And side effects aren't side effects. They are effects, too.
Well, what I got a kick out of this article is even though they're telling you how powerful the placebo effect is, they don't want to give up the medicine. So they're suggesting that in the future, placebos may provide a therapeutic boost to drug treatments. Instead of saying take the placebo instead, they want to boost the drug treatment by giving you a placebo with it.
Well, some people feel it's unethical to, quote, trick people. I don't think it's unethical at all.
Especially if you tell them it's a placebo.
Well, you could do that.
Both of these studies, they told them it was.
They did. You'll do better, however, if you don't tell them.
But I think what the point is here, I mean, this is really important to for doctors to help their patients, is to give them the information about their disease and explain it to them and be positive about it, you know, and tell them how this can help them.
That's some of it, but it's the relationship between the doctor and the patient that does most of the healing. And
positive message is what a lot of this is about, giving them a positive message.
Yes, I think that's really important. And at the same time, it's being there to walk the path of the illness together and to listen and to care to the patient. And if you can do that, then you have a partnership where there's a lot of trust. And the trust can mean lots of things. It can mean that, yes, I might give you a pill that is a sugar pill that has no effect, because I know that the placebo effect is substantial, and it's a lot safer to give you something that has a good chance of working, that doesn't cost much, that's safe. What could be better than that, rather than the stupid conclusion that this particular paper comes to and says it's a great adjunct to medication? What kind of silly thinking is that? The only time I'd be thinking about medication is if the placebo didn't work, which it may not. So the whole thing...
But see, I would think that a lot of people would be turned off by that thought and that it wouldn't work. However, I think that the mind does things that we can't really control.
You can't begin to understand or control.
And this is going to take away your pain, or it's going to stop your irritable bowel syndrome.
Or anything. I mean, why not use it for
anything? A lot of times people say, oh, isn't that all in your head?
Yeah, well, it's real. If you feel it, it's real. I don't care how you want to describe it, but you don't want to belittle it because it's something that is working just because it doesn't have some kind of biochemical effect, including all of what we call side effects that, of course, aren't side effects at all. They're real effects of the drug.
But people say that about a lot of alternative things, too. They do it about energy healing and acupuncture.
Sure.
They do it about the photon stimulator. They do it about a lot of different things. You know, people will say that are in doubt. They'll say, oh, it's just a placebo.
Yeah.
Don't do it.
Well,
they'll go like, don't do it. Like, it's going to hurt. It's not safe.
Well, I don't know of a better, safer, less expensive treatment than a placebo. And I think that what you want from your healthcare practitioner is something that helps you in the safest way that's possible. You know, the first thing we learn as we take our Hippocratic oath is first
do no harm.
And yet when it comes to clinical practice, it's like we never read the thing.
Well, it's good for people to have expectations, to know what's supposed to happen, you know, and
how
to feel better.
Well, and that can apply for any illness. Instead of using the drastic things that we use sometimes that are causing a lot of deaths. You know, there are 150,000 deaths, or more than that. There are 106,000 deaths, according to the Journal of the American Medical Association, September 1998 article that looked at the expected side effects of drugs only in the hospital. 106,000 expected deaths. You can imagine how many deaths there are that are the expected side effects of drugs that are used in all of America.
So how do you think this could change the double-blinded placebo control studies?
I don't even give a stuff about them. What I want to do.
But how can they test things if they don't do it with a placebo?
Well,
or they subtract 50% of that effectiveness.
Well, I don't know that you necessarily have to change them. You can do them just like we're doing, and we know what the placebo effect is, but it's not exactly what I'm looking for in an outcome study. But it's a very good question. Anyway, it's time for a network station break. You're listening to Prescriptions for Health. I'm Dr. Len Sabuda here with Nurse Vicki, and we'll be right back with more Prescriptions for Health radio. And when we come back, we'll be talking about the ironic effects of weight stigmatizing messages. What the heck is that? Stay tuned.
Weight reduction continues to be a hot topic, especially at the beginning of the new year.
I'll say. All these New Year's resolutions are going to last till when? Valentine's Day.
Oh, is that it?
Then we start over again.
Oh, then you start giving people chocolates.
Well, that's right.
Here's something to think about. Attaching negative messages to overweight encourages self-control, and as a result, it stigmatizes it, and it seems to have a negative effect on motivating people to lose weight.
Yeah, it makes sense. I mean, think of what it was like when you used to smoke. And I used to say, you got to stop this smoking and all this. It would do what? Make you want to smoke more.
Yeah, right? Or when I would read about it.
Right. And
then I would light up while I was reading about it.
Right.
So probably you get your bonbons while you're reading about this. Losing weight, they're eating their bonbons.
That's right.
But they said in this article, too, about reading about losing weight increases your stress and your appetite.
Yeah.
So how do we turn this around?
Oh, well, you don't want to take that approach. I mean, you got to be more thoughtful about what's happening. You know, weight loss takes a lot more than willpower. And there are a lot of reasons why people become overweight that we need to deal with.
And that word willpower is what makes people more stressed about it, and then they end up eating more.
Exactly. I mean, there are a lot of endocrine problems like hypothyroidism or adrenal problems or ovarian problems. And we got problems that relate to diet and exercise and post-traumatic stress and insomnia, got environmental toxins, a lot of drugs that we take do that.
But this study is mostly about people that are overweight, they are definitely overweight.
Okay, so the point
so
I'm
focusing
making
on their self-control can increase their feelings of helplessness, and then it can lead to out-of-control eating.
Well, that's right. But think of it this way. Okay, a reason I brought this other stuff up is, what if you're hypothyroid? Then is this going to be something?
Well, that's not what this study's about, though.
I know, but they need to look at things like that, too. And we need to bring the attention of these kinds of things to the surface as well, because we've got to be fair. What about somebody that's exposed to environmental toxins? Their body's inflamed, and they have leptin resistance and insulin resistance. These people are going to have an appetite that's bigger, that's hard to stop. And so just telling them, hey, you're kind of fat, stop eating, and you'll be better off, and it's a problem with your emotions and willpower, lots of problems there. But you're right. This study that was published in the Journal of Experimental Social Psychology really basically said that when women perceive themselves as overweight, when they're exposed to people that are criticizing them for that, they're less able to control their eating afterwards. It's something that's
real.
Well,
the thing is that people that aren't overweight don't get it because they get the opposite effects themselves. And so if you don't see yourself as overweight, this would work.
Yeah, maybe.
But
yeah,
if you
that's
see
right.
yourself as overweight, it doesn't.
That's exactly what they found. They talked to women who didn't have this feeling of being overweight, and they did a lot better. They didn't get all the anxiety, and they didn't overeat. But in this particular study, what they did is they had half of the participants, and they were young women, read a mock article from the New York Times that was titled "Lose Weight or Lose Your Job." The other half read a similar article that said "Quit Smoking or Lose Your Job." Now, after reading the articles, they were asked to describe what they read to someone who was unfamiliar with the content. Then they had a 10-minute break. And during that break, they were ushered into another room and asked to wait for the next phase of the experiment to begin. And what was available to them was a room that was full of different kinds of snacks, like M&Ms and Goldfish crackers and stuff like that. And they pre-weighed all of those snacks that were there to see how much the people would eat. And the people who had seen the berating film about how you had to lose weight or lose your job and made them feel bad, they ate a lot more.
Well, it's a vicious circle. They get stressed, and their blood pressure goes up thinking about it.
Exactly.
And they get scared, and then they just start eating more.
Exactly.
Well, too, I thought it was interesting that 90% of people that lose weight gain it back in 2 years.
Oh, for sure.
But think about what happened with Oprah. Remember when she went on that major diet, and she lost all that weight, and she was so happy.
Yeah, she had this trainer that was staying right on her all the time.
And she pushed out that wheelbarrow onto the stage
with however many
pounds of fat was it she lost.
Yeah, but
how embarrassing. She finally just said she was not going to do it anymore.
Well, she accepted who she was. And let's face it, people who are slightly overweight live a little longer than people who are either what is an ideal weight or a weight that's underweight, which is contrary to what we thought. Now, if you're obese, that's another story. There, your risk for having all kinds of problems with your health goes up.
Well, the hardest thing is to keep it off. I mean, it's hard to take it off, but then to keep it off, like they say, that 90% gain it back in 2 years. It's psychologically unhealthy to go through all of this.
Well, it's physically unhealthy as well. So we've got to go back and look at why are people overweight and pay attention to that rather than categorize people as not having any willpower.
A lot of people are very critical of those that are overweight.
Well, you need a good healthcare practitioner who understands why people overeat or why their metabolism is slow. You know, we do a test called a bioenergy test where at the Health Medicine Center where I work. We did years ago, and we're about to start this up again. That was phenomenal. That looked at how our bodies worked in the basal metabolic rate, meaning how active is our thyroid. And this is the gold standard for how you do it, not the blood test.
Doesn't your metabolism change when you're overweight anyway, even if it's not being caused by a thyroid problem?
It may slow down some, yes. A lot of people do. And it speeds up when you exercise. And it slows down when you don't sleep or when you're under stress. Or if you have endocrine problems or you're taking certain kinds of drugs that change your appetite. A lot of the antipsychotic drugs cause people to gain 25, 30, 50, 75 pounds.
Wow.
So we're really looking at a topic that's very complicated that shouldn't be just ushered into one place that says, if you don't have any willpower, you can't lose weight, and it's all about willpower. And, of course, this study focused on that because that's what they were looking at. And it's a good thing to know what the study said, but it doesn't tell the whole story.
Well, also they were talking about some people were literally like just dying to be thin. And I was thinking about binging and some of the eating disorders that people have focus so much
on their weight. And binge eating are all even more complicated that are usually related to a lot of abuse, particularly sexual abuse in childhood. It's amazing how that is correlated with people who have eating disorders.
But also the reward centers in the brain change when you're overweight.
Oh, they do. I mean, look what happens to us between Thanksgiving and New Year's. The average American gains 8 pounds. Why? Because it's a season for eating. And our appetite center changes. And unfortunately, trying to get it back down to where it was before is not so easy. And that's why there's a gradual increase in weight as we age.
So what's the answer? What do we focus on?
Well, I think we got to, one, be open about the fact about what our weight is. And then go to a good healthcare practitioner that knows what we have to do to stay healthy when it comes to weight. I mean, if we don't sleep well, our appetite's going to be up. If we're under a lot of stress, a lot of the time that happens. If we're exposed to a lot of environmental toxins, we need to know those things. And then, of course, there's a psychological side, too. And if we are exposed to some of the stresses that, in general, we're exposed to in our society because we're critical of people that are overweight, I mean, that makes all the difference in the world.
Well, I think focusing on good health, mm-hmm. which includes exercise and diet and getting enough sleep, all the lifestyle measures, and trying to not focus so much on the weight and the base, the BMI, body mass index.
Well, that's right. I think that's a huge.
But it's easier said than done.
Well, that's why we have 2/3 of America overweight. And we have about one third of America that's actually obese, and it's getting worse. And it's not all because people don't have any willpower.
And there are programs for people too, you know. Yeah,
they basically don't work. I mean,
look at
Oprah.
Eating disorder
Oprah
programs.
Had the
but
best program you could get,
programs.
And look what happened to her. I mean, she got down to a weight that looked pretty darn good.
But was it a psychological program?
Well, yeah.
That's why I'm trying to say that some of the eating disorder programs can be helpful.
It's a good point.
Because it's a psychological help.
It's part of the problem. That's right. You're listening to Prescriptions for Health. I'm Dr. Len Sabuda here with Nurse Vicki, and it's time for Nurse Vicki's final 2020 tip on life lessons to unlearn. And we got a few of those. And when we come back, we'll be talking about what mineral that treats osteoporosis can cause heart attacks and blood clots. And it's not what you're going to be thinking, so this is a good one. And what about workplace wellness programs? Do they work?
Some life lessons to unlearn. Problems are bad. Problems are not always bad because many times we can learn from what our problems are and they can help us to find a solution to what gives life its meaning.
Exactly.
Another one is that it's important to stay happy. Well, you know, it's okay to be sad if you need to be sad.
Yeah.
And this is kind of a permission to feel the way you feel.
Yeah, be authentic.
It's not normal to be continuously happy.
Exactly.
I'm irreparably damaged by my past. You know, many times we can learn from our past and painful events. Maybe they can leave some scars, but they're largely erasable. And many times we can, like, question those habitual thoughts and then begin to offload those patterns and to learn to let it go. Also, working hard leads to success. Many people, like babies and animals and all that kind of thing, they learn by playing. And sometimes we have instinctive skills to handle some of the real-world situations. So
sure, let our work be our play. Right?
Yeah, so a lot of times play is the key to success. Yeah,
absolutely.
And then here's another one to unlearn. Success is the opposite of failure. You know, a lot of times people worry about their mistakes and then they shut down. But if you can, like, take it a little bit more lightly, many times success is built on failure. That's how we learn.
Well, think of all the mistakes we make that we learn in life that take us to where we need to be. That's right.
Another one to unlearn is that it matters what people think of you. You know, this can really be upsetting if you think that people don't think well of you and so forth. But this can cause horrible things like despair and suicide and homicides and that kind of thing. So imagine what you'd do if it didn't matter what people thought of you.
Right. It'd be great. I mean, you shouldn't necessarily have to feel bad because some fool thinks you're an idiot about something, right?
Yeah. Another one is that we should think rationally about our decisions.
Yeah.
You know, we are animals, but instead of weighing the pros and cons intellectually, notice your physical response to each option.
And your emotions,
pay attention to how your body tenses or relax, mm-hmm. and then go with that. And another one is that the pretty girls get all the good stuff. Because many times these lovely pretties may get preferential treatment, but while everybody's looking at them, often nobody really notices her soul.
That's for sure.
And if all my wishes came true right now, life would be perfect. So is that really right? Well, check it out. People who have what you want are all over rehab clinics, divorce courts, jails, because good fortune can have side effects. Just like the meds on TVs.
That's right.
But the external things that we depend on to make us feel good has the power to make us feel bad. So when you stop depending on the tangible rewards, many times that's when they materialize,
that's
you
right.
know, to attract something that you want. So become as joyful as you think that thing would make you. And then the joy, not the thing, is the point anyway. And another one is that loss is terrible. Well, you know, smile when you're sad. Pretend like people, you like people that have appalled you. What is that? I mean, that's like abandoning yourself. That's the loss of your heart and your soul. So if you've abandoned yourself in an effort to keep anyone or anything else, unlearn that pattern and just live your truth. Because that's your heart and soul.
Yeah, look inside. I mean, if you be what I call authentic, then you're being who you are and not being restricted by what people think of you, and you're getting what that little voice inside that's so smart knows is right. Follow your heart.
Okay, so now onto the show. Trying to treat aging bones with medicines can be a problem. And it's important to look at the risks associated with the medications and to assess whether you really have bone loss with osteoporosis or if you have so-called osteopenia, which is also known as pre-osteoporosis. And we have a lot of information on drsaputo.com and the possible scary and dangerous side effects of the bisphosphonates like Fosamax and Boniva, just to name a few. Mm-hmm. Now, European regulators are halting the use of prolose and which are strontium ranelate.
Right, it's a mineral. That's right.
So what is wrong with strontium? Because I thought that it was a bone-building supplement that makes our bones strong, and it's in of the supplements.
It is, but when you have too much of anything, it can be a problem. I mean, it doesn't have to be necessarily strontium. You put lead or cadmium or mercury in your body in too much, or arsenic, it's a problem. And it's no different, as it turns out, with strontium. Now, strontium does some wonderful things. That's good. In fact, some of its of the effects that it have,
like bone growth.
Yeah, it increases the formation of bone tissue, and it does that in rats. And we've also followed people and looked at their bone mineral densities, and find out that they increase when they use this. And something like 4% per year in the lumbar spine, and 2% per year in the femoral neck, the hip. And over a period of 3 years, these numbers are like 10-15%. So they add up and make a big difference. But as it turns out, there are downsides to it, too. And now they're talking about rather large doses. They're talking about 2 grams a day. And I have to say, that's a huge dose.
And how much do you think is usually in a supplement?
A couple of hundred milligrams, okay? About a fifth of that would be what I would use, and I do use in my practice. But what they're saying is that the problems that we get into have to do with blood clots, okay? If you have a tendency to form blood clots in your legs, it puts you at risk for blood clots in your lungs, which can be a real big deal, or it can cause it on the arterial side of the body and cause heart attacks and strokes. So it's not like there's a huge increase, but there's some, and it's probably dose-related. And those aren't the only things that we see, because there are other kinds of problems like serious skin reactions, and sometimes you can even have seizures, liver inflammation, and some problems with anemia. So it's not like it's the end-all for or necessary to treat osteoporosis. I would say that this is great information that's come out of the European Medicines Agency, and it looks like they're going to take it off the market in Europe. I don't think it needs to be taken off the market, but it takes it in the U.S. or any place else, because I think that we can use it intelligently. Use small amounts. Don't use it in people who have thick blood.
Yeah, but these drugs that they're talking about, the prolose and the osteor, those have the large amounts. So those are the ones that they're going to take off the market.
Yes, and what you can do as a nutritional doctor or a nutritional specialist is use your judgment. Somebody's got a heart problem, or somebody's got a tendency towards blood clots, you'd have to be silly to be using any of it in those patients. But if you've got severe osteoporosis, are you going to turn to things like the bisphosphonates, you know, the Fosamax and drugs like it? And my answer would be those are far more dangerous. I mean, they cause osteonecrosis or disintegration of the jaw. And they can cause severe, severe constipation, esophageal ulcers and pains and bones and joints and muscles and lots of other problems that are really significant. And they don't even make strong bones like this strontium ranelate does.
Well, how else can you treat osteoporosis? What about vitamin D and vitamin K?
Yeah, now you're talking about the things that should be tried first. Certainly vitamin D. We'd like to bring our vitamin D levels up to 60 or 80 if we have a problem with thin bones. And vitamin K, as much as 15 milligrams a day, I think is a reasonable thing to do. And a little amount of a calcium supplement that's got micronutrients like magnesium and copper and boron and zinc and silica, because that's what bone's made of. Maybe you give 500 milligrams a day of that, but not more, because we're running into problems of, again, calcification in arteries. It puts us at risk for heart attacks and strokes.
And if you really don't want to get osteoporosis, cut back on the alcohol and smoking and
right, exercise.
And eat an alkaline diet.
Yeah. I mean, all these are the things that we should be focusing on the most, because that's where, use your common sense rather than rely on either a drug or even a lot of any particular mineral, because too much of anything is a problem.
What about fish oil?
I think that would be something that could be used in that setting, and you could also use something like nattokinase, which would help keep blood thin. And if you're concerned about it, you can do what's called a live blood cell analysis, and then you could see what the live blood cell analysis shows and determine whether or not you're at risk for clotting.
You know, it seems pretty obvious that if employees are healthy and happy, that their employer are going to get the best results from them all the way around.
Yeah, everybody wins in that setting, right?
And you wouldn't think that we'd need a study on this topic of wellness and prevention programs and corporations. But we have a surprisingly negative study on this at PepsiCo, where their wellness program failed.
Yeah.
And I just can't help but wonder if the counselors were sitting around drinking Pepsis when they were discussing this. You know, on the other side of the fence, there have been multiple corporations with huge success in their wellness programs, like Google and IBM and MD Anderson Cancer Center, American Express, and there are many, many more of those.
Absolutely.
So what makes a wellness program successful?
Well, it wouldn't be PepsiCo's, okay, because they did a study that showed that it didn't work. But they weren't doing the same thing that a lot of these other organizations were doing. I mean, you look at the stuff at Google and IBM and some of the other places that have wonderful programs, MD Anderson, American Express, the ones that you mentioned, those are great. And according to Corporate Wellness Magazine, every dollar that's spent in employee wellness programs yields about a $4 amount in savings through reduced sick days, higher productivity, and just decreased overall health costs. So they're saving money. This is a good thing.
So the PepsiCo company, their employees, they were complaining about the penalties if they refused to participate, and they wanted their privacy, and they said that the program promoted poor medicine.
Well, they were saying they were doing too many tests that were looking at things like cholesterol and blood sugar and stuff like that. And how much you do that is debatable, and you don't have to do that all every year. It depends on who you are and what your situation is. But when you're talking about what they did at PepsiCo, it wasn't much. I mean, they didn't have the wonderful things that some of these other organizations had. I mean, you look at what happened.
Well, they didn't save any money, and they claimed that their program was ineffective. But these other corporations...
Well, it was a little piddling program. I mean, they didn't have the big programs like some others did.
Well, they have some impressive corporate wellness programs. I mean, I couldn't believe some of the things that they have.
Well, look
there
at Yale New Haven Hospital. They have 13,000 square foot facility that's for living living well fitness, which is a great thing to do. And they have classes like spin and yoga and Zumba and relaxation. Some of the other places have nutrition and fitness coaching. They have and they found some really good things.
And they have weight loss support groups, and they cater to the working moms, and they have child care if it's necessary. If the kid is sick, they have a nurse there to take care of the child, and they have relaxation classes, and they even have, some of them have financial compensation reward programs, and they even have new parent bonuses. They make it fun. They have tuition reimbursements and travel insurance.
Yeah, it's not about lectures.
You can even go to the dentist at the office.
Okay.
You know, and anyway, they have all these great programs and health fairs and everything else and wellness education. And then they end up with less health care spending, and the employees do lose the weight. They have less stress levels. They're healthier. They're happier. They're inspired. They're motivated. They love their work. They like to go to work because it's fun.
Let's look at some of the numbers they have. Okay, American Specialty Health is one. They've got their own gym, and like you said, they've got nutrition and fitness coaching. Their weight program was 55% successful. They cut back in stress levels by 58%. They cut their health care costs by about $400 per person per year. I mean, these are numbers that really mean a lot. It's a lot different than what Pepsi was doing. And then to come out and say they don't work is just appalling. And then they start criticizing the Affordable Care Act. One of the great things that it does have at the Affordable Care Act is a program that looks at giving wellness exams and starting to reimburse for some of the programs that are important for preventive medicine.
Of course, sometimes they get things mixed up with wellness and screening.
Well,
know?
Early detection is not the same thing as wellness. You're right. All right. We're at the end of the show. I want to remind you that we'll be back to talk about what's new in the news and health the first and third Mondays of every month on PRN.FM and drsaputo.com, and from 10 to 11 a.m. Eastern Time and 7 to 8 a.m. Pacific Time. Prescriptions for Health will also be available 24/7 on PRN.FM.
If you enjoyed today's radio show and you'd like to have more information on the topics we discussed in video and free access to more than 2,500 audio and video files, click on Health Headlines on the drsaputo.com homepage. And remember, a healthy lifestyle is the most powerful healer in the universe. So if you want to be well, pay attention to the style in which you live your life.
We'll see you next time.